Romans chapter 12. We're going to look specifically at a very small part of Romans 12 where Paul the Apostle is writing to his church and he's instructing them on what a church family does considering all the good that God has done and considering the mercy of God and considering all the best that he has given and provided us. By the way, if you have any growing interest in learning more about what we've been talking about, being a part of a loving church family and in loving relationships with one another, living in community and coming out of isolation and being better connected in a deep, loving relationship that is primarily through other believers, we have a book that we have provided for you on this on the welcome wall. Before you leave today, there's still a couple of weeks where you would still be in sync with what we've been talking about, and just for what these cost us, you can buy one yourself and spend some time growing on your own. It's called Life in Community, Joining Together to Display the Gospel. We thought it might be helpful for you if you have a resource of your own to grow at home. So we're going to look at Romans chapter 12, verse 9, and just a small part of verse 9. It's actually, there's three parts of verse 9, and the last part is verse 9c. So we're going to look at that together today. Romans 12, verse 9c. Let's look at that verse here together. And it is very simply this. You'll see it on the screen behind me up there. It's in, very short. Hold tightly to what is good. Hold tightly to what is good. And Paul here is instructing believers in the church what it looks like when you have made your life a life of worship. And there's a whole series of things. A lot of it has to do with the way that you function in your believing, your relationships with other believers in a church family. And one of the things he says, and we talked about last week, is don't just pretend to love one another, really love each other. In order to really love someone, you have to become and allow yourself to be, by God's grace, the real you. And he also says show affection to one another, honor one another, all these one another's having to do with growing together in loving relationship. And today we're going to talk specifically about one of the best ways to really love someone. One of the best ways to really love someone is to cheer on the godliness that is surfacing in their life. And I am, it's a lot, if you are around people, people that you care about, loved ones, friends, and family, it is not difficult to see the damage that life does to people's families and relationships. Perhaps you have been taken back at times considering the way that abuse has injured and damaged somebody's fragile heart. And they have struggled to grow healthy and get beyond the abuse they've experienced in their life. And if you know somebody who's trapped in addiction, then you know that for many, almost what seems to be uncontrollably trading family and health and real living for the substance. And you have watched up close as their life has been tormented and terrorized by a substance in some kind of substance abuse or addiction. And you may have also become familiar with the way in which adultery has ruined families and marriages and people's personal lives and friendships and these types of trauma in people's lives are so disruptive and they do so much damage. And if you're close by to any one of those, or if one of those people that has experienced this is you, you know that it's almost, it's at times it almost feels hopeless that really anything is going to change or any real growth or any real progress is going to be made. Then other people experience in their life something that isn't necessarily damaging, but it's a profound distraction in their life. And whether it has to do with watching your child grow more and more apathetic to the Christian faith and to the person of Jesus and ultimately to faith in God, and as they grow more and more apathetic, you see them just distracted by so many lesser things. And others who grow distracted because they have arrogantly set their heart on accumulating lesser things And their arrogance says things like, I don't need God, I don't want God. If that's good for you, then so be it. I don't need a crutch, I'm not weak enough to really need a faith like this that you're explaining to me or that you've been pushing on me. And other people maybe are just distracted because they've grown a level of anger or bitterness in their own heart, and that has caused them to be very distracted from anything that God would want to do in their life. And it's primarily because they have a barrier, and it's an anger barrier. And either way, if you love somebody like that, if you care about somebody like that, it's difficult to have a relationship with somebody like that because of the disruption, the distraction, and all of the damage that's being done in their life by those life experiences. And here we are as God's church that is drawn into relationship with one another, and it should be and ought to be loving relationship with one another. And sometimes when you encounter people who are struggling with these kinds of things, wouldn't you admit it is so helpless sometimes? The sensation of just being helpless to help retrieve somebody who is being distracted or damaged by some of those abuses and addictions and arrogance and all the other ways in which that they are distracted and damaged, and it can feel so helpless. I wish there was more that could be done, and maybe you have experienced this in your own family, and you want your friends and your loved ones and your family to mature in their faith, and you want them to get better, and you want them to recover, and you want them to get over it. And maybe you've even said something like, you just have to get on with your life. You just have to get over it. And perhaps some of us spend some time warning our children about these dangerous situations or these dangerous places that you get in life where you have been damaged or distracted, and you warn your children. You spend time teaching your children. We've come to realize that when we're helping to teach and warn our children, they have a word for it. It's called lecturing them. Whether you teach or train or lecture your children to avoid distractions and the things that damage their life, when this type of damage happens and you think about the people that you know who were raised in a Christian family and a church family, and they were taught, they were trained, they were warned, and they were lectured to, but somehow they have never matured in their faith. Somehow, you may have already noticed that it has not been enough to just preach and teach and condemn the sin and the evil that is so easily entangles them, and they have not been able to avoid immorality and sin. Here's the thing. You and I don't have to sit by and watch. We don't have to sit by and hope that something good happens. We don't have to sit and get comfortable in a place of helplessness and watch someone be overtaken by hard-heartedness and unbelief. We don't have to sit by and watch. There is a God-given way. There's a God-given way. He's provided for us a specific and tangible way to help fight for their soul. I know this, that if any one of you had the luxury of being on a cruise ship and one of your loved ones fell overboard. Now, I've heard these stories of falling overboard, and I got to tell you, I've never been on a cruise, but I can't picture what it looks like to fall overboard, because aren't there guardrails on these ships? I don't understand it. I don't know how it happens. But evidently, I read that every year people die by falling overboard. And I would assume that when someone falls overboard, if someone sees them, who knows them and cares about them, there is some attempt made to retrieve them. Wouldn't you think? Don't you think somebody looks for some kind of, do they still use life rings? Are those still a thing? Life rings are a thing, right? Some of you, I know you throw, some people in your life, you throw them a life ring. Other people, you probably throw them an anchor. So here it comes. Hold on. Yeah. But most of us who have people that we love and care for, if something happens in their life where it looks like they're overboard and they're drowning, we want to do something. We want to throw them some kind of lifeline. Listen to this. God has provided a way specifically for us in loving relationship to help save somebody from destruction, the destruction of their soul. God's provided a way for us, a specific way for us to do something, so you and I don't have to sit on the sidelines and just say, I hope I can pray them back into the kingdom. While we should be doing that, we can do more. I hope they wake up. Some of us say, I hope they hit rock bottom. If that's what it takes, they might have to hit rock bottom before they bounce back or before they imagine this. Imagine you're friends with somebody, somebody that you have become familiar with. Let's say her name is Sarah, and she's a new believer. But she confesses to you that though she's a new believer, she's excited about her future, but she's really nervous about her past because she has baggage. She describes some of the things that are haunting her from her past as some demons in her life that every now and then continue to kind of torment her. Some bad habits, some abusive relationships, some painful memories in her life. All of this that has come, she admits, by her poor decisions that she's made and the painful consequences that go along with those decisions. Here's what you find out. You find out after a short conversation with Sarah that her life is pretty messy. You're excited about her new faith. You're hopeful. But if you've been around long enough, you know you also very, very aware and in tune with how much damage those demons can do in tormenting somebody and continuing to drag their spirit, drag their soul back where they came from. Each day, she admits to you that she struggles with the temptation to return to her former life. And in your heart, you have grown affectionate towards her and you want to help her avoid going back. You want to help protect her from going back and being dragged back into her painful lifestyle. Here's a question for you. What does Sarah need from you? What does she need from you? You have already started praying for her. You have already told your friends to be praying for her. Does she need someone to remind her of her foolish choices? And does she need someone who constantly prodding her to try harder and to be better and to be certain that she avoids all of the traps? Maybe not, but how do we fight for someone like Sarah's soul? What she needs most, perhaps, consider this. What if what she needs most from us or from you is a daily reminder of the evidence and evidences, a daily reminder of the evidences that God is at work in her life? What if what she really needs from us is to use this God-given and specific tactic to help care for her because we've grown affectionate toward her and we want to help her mature in her faith? And what if she needs something very specific from us? And here's what it is. It's our words. Our words. So we don't have to sit by and hope and cross our fingers and hope that she doesn't get dragged away. Even if she just makes small steps, what if it's only for a day or two that she's making progress? One of the best ways to fight the sin that she's going to be battling in her life is this, is to cheer on her godliness and to use our words to do it. While shame and the guilt of Sarah's past may produce change for a moment in her life, imagine that encouragement can cause transformation that lasts a lifetime in her. And here's what we know. The Proverbs teach us on wisdom, and the Proverbs say that there is power for life and there's power for death. And where do we find that power? The Proverbs teach us it's in our words. It's in our words. We can damage and kill someone with our words, and we can bring life and revive someone with our words. Using our words. Learning to use our words. Now, probably many of us have been a victim of someone's harsh words, and we have found it difficult to overcome the words that they've used. And I wonder how many of you would be able to even probably write it down and say, I will never forget when my father, my sibling, my boss, my coach growing up said to me, you will never, or don't even try, or they have used words that you have clung to and you've never forgotten those words, and somehow, slowly but surely, they have kind of caused a slow death in that part of your life. But there's also words that bring life, and some of you have clung to those words, and when you need to, you recall those words, and those words help to urge you forward and to take another step and to continue to grow in your own inner life and in your soul. How many have ever heard of the love languages? Gary Smalley teaches this thing called love languages, and one of the ways that Gary Smalley teaches that we love our spouse is to learn their love language. I discovered shortly after taking that course that my love language was all of them. I told my wife that I have all the love languages. That's how I receive love, all of them. Extended, quality, personal touch. And if you, the theory goes like this, that Gary Smalley says that there is one specific kind of love language called verbal affirmation, and when you affirm somebody verbally, it's a way in which you kind of inflate them and you love them, and they sense the love, they receive the love, and they grow in their love bank. There's a deposit in their love bank. Verbal affirmation. You know, verbal affirmation is not just a technique in marriage. It's a biblical, it's a specific biblical principle to help grow somebody who you love, and every Christian ought to be able to count on the cheering encouragement of their believing friends. Every one of us ought to be able to count on we're going to have believing friends who are cheering us on and who are encouraging us and using words to do it. To really love someone, you have this in your notes, to really love someone, here's what Paul teaches: glue yourself to what is good. Glue yourself to what is good. To really love someone, glue yourself to what is good. What does that mean? Here's what he's saying. He uses the phrase, hold tightly to what is good. You may have a version of the scriptures that say, cling to what is good. You may have a version that uses another word, but cling, hold tightly, no matter how, hold fast. You may have that version in your text that you're looking at there. But here's what it all means. It comes from the same word. All those phrases to describe this comes from the same word, which means to glue. To glue. Hate what is evil, but glue yourself to what is good. Glue yourself to what is good. That means that if you love somebody, you hate the evil that's destroying their life, but that's not it. You don't just hate the evil that's destroying their life. You also find a way to love, cling to, if you love them, you cling to or you glue yourself to the good things. And clinging to what is good means that you're able to express a sticking or a bonding. There's something you're able to do to help them stick to and cling to and be glued to the good. This is the same with fitness. Some of you loathe these. I know you loathe these fitness illustrations because it's a constant reminder. But it's the same thing with fitness. If you have a good fitness trainer, the fitness trainer is not screaming every time they think that you go near a cupcake and saying, "Cupcake's bad. Shameful. Don't forget about the guilt that you're going to be riddled with as soon as you scoop that piece of cheesecake into your mouth." Because a key to getting physically fit is not just loathing and hating and despising sweets, but would you admit that would go a long way? But that's not it. You can't just loathe cupcakes and cake and cheesecake and ice cream. You can't just hate it. A good fitness trainer will help you to learn to glue yourself to healthful nutrition and physical activity. And this is very similar to what Paul is saying. He's saying, hate the bad stuff, but you've got to find a way, if you really love people, to glue yourself to the good things that are happening in their life. And what is the good that we glue ourselves to? I think that's worth asking, right? What is the good that we glue ourselves to? What is the good that we're holding so tightly to? And if you have an astute mind for theology, you may already have been thinking through this idea that if it's true that we are totally depraved, meaning there is no good in us at the beginning, in our nature and in our core, that we start in what the Bible calls, in a systematic theology phrase, totally depraved. Nothing good, completely wicked, fully evil. In fact, God describes it this way: enemies with God, separated from Him, A wall of hostility built up. We're dead in our sin. So what good do we have to offer? What good is there that we're clinging to? Can a depraved person be good? And if we're not careful, we misconstrue what Paul means when he says, glue yourself to the good that is working in someone's life. So, number one, this is not the idea of clinging to someone's outer good. This is not, when you cling to the good that's happening in somebody, don't think in terms of outer good, right? We're not talking about noticing how good someone looks. We're not talking about noticing how good somebody acts. We're not talking about things related to vanity, because as you know, vanity can be something that someone becomes enslaved to. We're not clinging to compliments or flattery, not someone's new haircut or not someone's new outfit, not the new cool vehicle that they're driving. There's an author, Sam Crabtree, he says, consider the way Jesus affirmed people. Consider the things that he noticed. Consider the things that Jesus complimented or the good that Jesus noticed about someone else. Here's what Jesus didn't say, hey, I want you to pay very special attention to John the Baptist, who's the greatest man on earth, and notice that beard. I mean, did you see his beard? He gets all the locusts out of it. No signs of honey stuck in it anywhere. He's just got such a great beard. Jesus doesn't necessarily pay any attention to the outer shell of a person. In fact, Jesus affirmed a woman for her faith. Jesus affirmed a soldier for his faith. Jesus affirmed a widow for her generosity. He noticed someone's faith. He noticed someone's generosity. And he affirmed it. He clung to what is good in something that was occurring in someone's character. We're also not referring to the idea of clinging to your inner good. Clinging to esteem, clinging to self-esteem can actually enslave you. Not to mention that Jesus is teaching and they call him good. And he says, now you need to be careful because when you use the word good, you can't just throw that word around. Really, there's no one good except my Father. There's no one good but God alone. So even Jesus is hesitant when someone starts throwing the word good around. And he says, Paul teaches, there's not one who is righteous, not one person. So everything that you do that is pleasing to God, keep this in mind. It is being produced by God. Let me say it again. Here's what the scriptures teach us. Everything that we do that's good is being produced in us by God. Anything that we do good for God is being done through us by God. The Spirit is at work, causing any of the good that we do to be done through us or in us, according to Hebrews 13:21. He produces in us, through the power of Jesus, every good thing that's pleasing to Him. And here's what God does. He gives us His good. God takes all the selfishness, all the depraved selfishness that is naturally in our heart. Here's what God does. He, over time, transforms that selfishness and He replaces it with selflessness. All of the pride that so naturally rises up and kind of drives us in our own inner life and makes us do the things we do, God goes to work in us and the Spirit is at work in us and the Spirit replaces that pride with a growing humility. God goes to work in us, and by His grace and according to His mercy, He takes all the apathy that some of us suffer with on a regular basis, and over time, He slowly overwhelms that apathy with a new passion. Here's what God does. God takes the goodness in His own character, and He gives it to us. He works it out and places in us selflessness and humility, and He replaces our pride and apathy and foolishness with His good. He's at work doing good in us. And here's what we have to remember. It is not good enough to only hate and confront the sin that the people we love are doing. Children, friends, family, parents, cousins, whoever you're close to and you share a loving relationship with. We must also intentionally build the kind of relationships that actively encourage and affirm one another in the areas that God is visibly at work in us. If you want to cling to and you want to glue yourself to the good that God is doing in somebody, notice it. Remind them of it. The things that are visibly being done by God in their life. Every member of the body of Christ is able to take hold of everyday opportunities to speak the uplifting, encouraging word to cling to the good that God is doing in someone. So how do we do that? How do we help make someone grow in their faith, mature in their faith? How do we restore someone in their faith? And here it is. You've got this in your notes too. Use your words to put strength into somebody. Use your words to put strength into somebody. Now, this is very specific. It's specifically about words. And the idea here is that we can use our words to inject strength into somebody while we don't just condemn the evil and the wickedness and all of the sin that so easily entangles. We also become very, very specific and diligent and deliberate about using words to put strength into the people we love. There's a passage in Hebrews, and the author of Hebrews kind of describes this as warning believers, warning them. Warning them. Here's what he says in Hebrews 13, chapter 3, verse 13. You must warn each other every day while it is still today, so that none of you will be deceived by sin and hardened against God. See, he's talking about how do we help somebody and protect them from becoming hard-hearted towards God. How many of you would say, you can think of somebody whose heart has grown hard towards God? It is no longer sensitive. It is no longer passionate and urgent and tender-hearted towards God or the things that God loves. And they roll their eyes at the conversation about God or faith. Or you try to say, hey, look at the consequences of this. And they're so sick of hearing it. They don't want to hear it anymore because their heart has grown hard. Here's what the author of Hebrews says, that we must warn each other every day. Now, check this out. This is actually a phrase that means biblical, or that is a phrase that is really biblical encouragement. Warn each other is, the word warning is biblical encouragement. Here's what it means. So put your words into use to point out examples of God's goodness at work in someone's life. Using words. Now, some of you have children, and I imagine if you have young children, maybe your mind is just being flooded with the ways in which you can use words in biblical encouragement to point out the good things that God is at work doing in their hearts. And when you imagine that, what you're imagining is you're imagining the ways in which we can use strong encouragement, and that's what the author of Hebrews is saying. Use strong encouragement. You've got that in your notes. You've got blanks there. Use strong encouragement. What does this idea mean, to warn each other or to use strong encouragement? Here's what the idea. The author of Hebrews has this word picture in mind. Now, some of you have seen Braveheart. I want to ask you to admit publicly that you've seen the movie, because it's rated R, and I know how some of you feel about that. I want you to embarrass yourself publicly. But there's a scene in Braveheart where they're just about to go into battle against the British or the English soldiers. And by the way, if you can imagine, the British are more like an empire, and they have a military more like an empire. And here's these little ragtag tribes from the Highlands and the Northlands and Scotland and so on, and they're kind of ragtaggy tribes, and Braveheart is racing back and forth in his horse, and he's calling them to battle, and he's saying, we're going to fight, but we're not going to fight for any other reason than one driving reason, and it's for freedom. And he goes back and forth and back and forth, and he's just riling them up. He is inflating them. How many of you saw that? Don't raise your hand. I don't want to raise your hand. And he's pumping them up. And think of this. He is providing for them strong encouragement for the battle to come. He is inflating them with courage and strength. And he's doing so with words. And the words that he's using are these. The way that he's using his words comes from this word paraclete in the scripture, which means to encourage, to provide strong encouragement. And it's the picture, the Hebrews author is saying, of a commander in the military who is inflating, who is injecting, who is putting strength into, he's putting confidence, he's heartening them, or he is empowering them with strength before his soldiers go off to battle. And the author of Hebrews is saying this, warn each other, provide strong encouragement. Use strong encouragement to prepare the hearts of the soldiers for battle. If you have a loved one that you care about who's struggling with all kinds of life damage and life distractions, and they have dealt with all kinds of heartache and turmoil, they need strong encouragement. They don't only need us to warn them that there's lots of pitfalls and don't go back, and that while they may, and while that's effective, and while we see Paul encouraging us to do that here as well, they also need somebody to inflate them with strong encouragement. And the way that we do that, the way that we provide a strong encouragement for a lot of people is face-to-face. And be careful not to rely simply on digital exchanges with them, but provide face-to-face moments. And here's what else. The author of Hebrews says that we ought to do so. We ought to provide that strong encouragement by saying something. And we have to say something now before it's too late. You have that in your notes. Before it's too late. While it's still today. Isn't that a funny way to say it? While it's still today. Every day while it's still today, provide strong encouragement. Be a paraclete. That's the word. While it's still today. And here's what he's trying to say. He's trying not to just say every day, but he's also trying to say the reason that you do it every day is so that you are doing it now before it's too late. Because there is a moment in time where somebody has fallen off and they've gone overboard, and you begin to realize that they could have used strong encouragement a long time ago, and it seems like it's too late. And we know that with God's restoration power and his renewal power, that it's not too late. It's never too late. And failure is never final, and all of those inspiring aspects of being renewed by God. But the author of Hebrews says, every day before it's too late, spend time daily giving strong encouragement. Use your words to provide strong encouragement. Think of the people that you see daily. When you think of the people that you see daily, sometimes your coworkers come to mind, and you're trying to imagine having anything to say to them that would inspire them, that would encourage them, that would otherwise provide strong encouragement, and the idea of helping them as they go into battle. Think in terms of their personal lives and some of the things that people confide in you when they're dealing with turmoil in their lives. How do we encourage them? Find a way to point out the evidences of God's grace that is at work within them. Let me get even more specific, and maybe this will be even more helpful for you. Number three, we can use six sticky words, very sticky words, because we're trying to glue people to the good. We're trying to glue ourselves to the good. We're trying to glue the good that God is at work doing in somebody to the person that he's doing it to. Use six sticky words. Here they are. You have them in your notes. I see God working in you. If you're a spouse, try this with the person you're married to. If you're a parent, try using this more often on a daily basis before it's too late. Use this with your kids. If you're a child and you want to encourage your parent who is going through a tough time in the phase of life that they found themselves in, use these six sticky words. I see God working in you. Every now and then, someone will mention to me, Pastor, a long time ago, you were my youth pastor, as you know, and something you said really meant something to me. And occasionally, this just happened recently, someone took a digital picture of a note that I had written them when we were preparing for a missions trip, and they took a picture of it and sent it to me and said, I keep this in my Bible. And every now and then I just read over it. And God uses it and he encourages me, and God just reminds me. And it reminds me that our words put strength into people. Encouragement puts strength into people. But, you know, I used to have to teach when we were preparing for a missions trip and we were writing encouragement cards to people. Do you know that when we have ninth graders going writing encouragement cards, wouldn't you imagine they need a little coaching on how to do this? Because the boys would write these cards and the girls would bring them to us and say, did you see this? I mean, this is powerful. I really like the sweater you wore last Wednesday night. That's so powerful. Come on. One sentence about my sweater? I hated that sweater. I'm not going to ever wear it again now. And we used to have to help coach some of the, not just boys, you know, we used to have to coach people and say, here's what the idea is. With strong encouragement, when you're trying to inject encouragement and help somebody cling to the good, what you're doing is you're using six sticky words. You're simply saying this. Glue yourself, you're helping them glue to the good by saying this. I see God at work in you, and here's how I see him at work in you. And by doing that, what you're doing is you're helping to avoid, elevate a person, and you're not contributing to their self-esteem, because you don't necessarily want to help them begin to trust in themselves more. What you're trying to do is do something that's good for them that also glorifies God. So you're affirming very carefully, very specifically, with six sticky words that God is at work in you. I see him at work in you, and you are making a difference, and he is clearly doing something unique and special. And this is what it does. It can help change the trajectory of somebody's life who is wobbly, who is getting off track, who is in the shoulder of the road and it looked like they were going to go off in a ditch. Sometimes putting this kind of strength in somebody helps to just show them up on the rails. Sometimes it helps people change lanes and get back on the faith highway that God wants to lead them through and lead them down. And the power of those six words, it may be just a drop in the bucket that is the tipping point to cause an avalanche of transformation in your wife, in your kids, in your coworkers, or in a friend or a loved one. Or even that person that's in your small group and you just can't figure out how they don't know that they're a little socially awkward, but your words, your sticky words, I see God working in you, could be the tipping point that helps transformation begin to occur in their life. Some of you are good writers. Write those words. Some of you are good talkers. Talk those words. There is a life-giving authority in the words that we use to help spur one another on toward maturity in our Christ. And listen, if you want to put strength into your husband or into your wife to change, and you have been wondering, are they ever going to change? How can I get them to change? And some of you have given up on nagging. You have just come to realize that you're not necessarily getting the results you were hoping for using the nagging technique. Consider this. When your spouse serves you or serves someone else or demonstrates humility, or demonstrates selfless sacrifice, someone who normally struggles to give of themselves, make it a clear point to put strength into them and acknowledge, I see God at work in you. Glue them to the good that God is doing in them. You want to put strength into a mother or a father to change when you see them. And perhaps it's a mother or father who is fighting to have patience with their four-year-old, which may be happening every 10 minutes. They're struggling to have patience with their four-year-old or their little family, and they show an extra measure of patience or an extra measure of tolerance. Glue yourself to the good and you say, I see God working at you by providing you with just enough patience. Most moms and most dads will be stunned to hear that anybody's acknowledged that they're not blowing up and losing their cool. If you want to help your boss, you want to put strength in your boss, and you want to show your boss, when you see your boss showing grace to someone, when they normally don't show grace, they tend to be hard on people whose performance is lacking. When you see them show grace and you want to help them change, speak affirming words about their leadership and how you notice that they demonstrated grace to somebody. Glue them to the good. You want to put strength into your child to change, and you're watching them make a decision to treasure Jesus rather than give in and give way to peer pressure. Tell them that you see it. You see how they're treasuring and you see how they're trusting Jesus. You see how they've tasted and seen that the Lord is good and that they are choosing to embrace that and to glue themselves to that. And you help glue themselves to that with, I see God working in your life. He's at work and I see it. It's both good for them and it glorifies God. And here's one author, Sam Crabtree, who's written extensively about practicing biblical affirmation. Here's what he said. God is glorified in us when we affirm the work he has done and is doing in others. Have you realized that you get more of the behaviors that you affirm from our kids, from our friends, and from our family. Let me say that again. We get more of the behaviors that we affirm. Have you noticed that? If you have a little one around in the house, if you pay attention to their misbehaving, you get more misbehaving. If you pay attention to their good behavior, you get better behavior, right? I mean, maybe that's not a rule. But in general, I think it's fair to say that you get more of what you pay attention to. And it's not enough to repeatedly say to our kids, no, no, and give them a stinger on their hands. It's not enough to continually warn them about the traps and the pitfalls and the potholes. And if I even mention to my teenage children now that, hey, pay attention to the deadly path that substances, addictive substances like drugs and alcohol, pay attention to the path that often drags people on, and I get the rolling of the eyes. Oh, I'm not in health class. Am I in health class? I feel like I'm in health class. I have to figure out a way to do more than just scold them for, or warn them of the traps. I have to be intentional. If I want to help them avoid rebellion and apathy, I have to pay more attention intentionally and affirm every one of the mature choices they make, every one of the caring attitudes they demonstrate, and every moment in which they selflessly express their heart motives. I have to be careful that I reward the desired behavior. And you've heard of this, Pavlov's dogs, right? Haven't you? That if you reward certain behaviors positively, you get more of the same behavior. There's something in us that God has wired us to respond to deep encouragement to do more of the same. Let me put it this way. If you want to encourage a believer, deeply encourage a believer, point out the good that God is doing in them rather than the good they're doing for God. Let me say that again. You'll see it on the screen behind me. Point out the good that God is doing in them rather than the good that they're doing for God. And what you're doing is you're putting strength into them in this way. You are acknowledging that something good is happening in them, and you're also glorifying the God who's responsible for doing it. Now, why don't we naturally do this? Wouldn't you think that we would naturally use these words? Why don't we naturally glue to the good? And it can be difficult to be an encourager because we're naturally self-centered. And our selfishness leaks out in a number of ways. One of the reasons why we don't encourage very well is because of the comparison condition. We tend to be, by default, people of comparison. And when we see good things happening in someone, oftentimes we are struck by an overly competitive or comparison that really steals our joy. It steals our joy for them, and it steals our joy for ourselves. Mark Twain says, comparison is the death of joy. If you want to kill joy, compare yourself and what's happening in and around other people. Comparison is the authentic encouragement killer. Because rather than affirming what God is doing in someone, we start asking questions like, well, what in the world's going on with me? How come I don't have that, live that, look like that, feel like that, experiencing that same work that God is doing? Secondly, there's this gender-based dude disorder. And what I mean by that is that there are, in particular, guys, I'm sure also women, but in particular guys, who struggle with sarcasm and coarse joking and a level of pride that blocks our capacity not just to receive correction, but hinders our ability to affirm somebody. Pride and sarcasm. So our words that we use aren't putting strength into somebody. It's coarse joking and sarcasm that substitutes and counterfeits our words. And instead of doing something, putting strength into somebody with words of encouragement, it tends to be lighthearted, have barbs on it, and be prickly. Now, for a lot of people, that's the reason why they don't use these words. And there's one third reason. It's nearsightedness. Because of our self-centeredness, we just can't see beyond ourselves, and there are times where we just don't notice the good that God is doing in somebody. We just don't notice that God is the good that's being done. There's one of my favorite comedians. His name is Brian Regan. Brian Regan tells this fantastic story. If you use YouTube, I'm sure you could find this bit called the Me Monster. and he is doing this bit where he mocks the person at the party who always has to one-up you. So you say something, and he gives this bit, and he says, he hears somebody say me, or they say they hear you say something about you, and then they say me. And then this person hears you say something about you, and then they say, no, you me. And he goes all the way up, you me, no, you me. And he just keeps illustrating that there's this monsters in all of these social circuses, that social circles that have to one up. And if you say something, then they have to say, well, no me. Well, you just got attention. Well, no me. You just told a funny joke. Well, no me. And then up and up and up it goes as this me monster. And his claim is that all of us naturally know somebody or can become somebody who's the me monster. And when you get that nearsighted, it's difficult to see God at work in somebody. And there's no way we can affirm somebody and put strength into somebody with encouraging words like, I see God working in you. If we're so nearsighted, all we can really see is me, and this me monster has begun to develop. Do you know these people? I live with five of them. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. That's not fair. That's not fair. Raquel, wherever you are, I didn't mean that. Forgive me for saying that publicly. Forgive me for confirming that. What would it take? Let me ask you this. What would it take? What would it take for us? What would it take for us to daily do this? What would it take? What would it take to daily, before it is too late? I mean, think of this. How do you feel when you receive a handwritten note and somebody affirms, I see God at work in you? And what's stopping you from turning the tables and doing the same on a daily basis? Not too long ago, I was inspired to do this more often, and I like to write, and I have a pen that I love to use, and was inspired, and God is just working in my own heart, saying, Dan, become an encourager and put strength into people with your words. Some of you are great at this. But what's stopping you from doing it? Is it that we don't feel like we're good at it? Is it possible that we just feel like we don't have time? Maybe you feel like you're just too preoccupied or is it possible that we just genuinely don't care that much? For most people, that's not true. For most people, we care, and this is specific and something very deliberate that we can do, where we create a daily habit of encouragement and gluing other people to the good that God is at work doing in them. How might you make this an intentional part of the rhythm of your life? Let me say this, our church family, if when we're a biblical church family, we ought to be the most encouraging group of people that anybody could be around. Why? Because God is at work in us. And when God is at work in us and people are paying attention to that, you know what they want to do? They want to be around us more. And when we're a church family who is using words to put strength into people and be their paraclete, you find joy, and you hear these affirming words, and you're reminded of God's goodness himself, his own goodness. And God has given us a gift, and it's loving relationships. It's the church family and our loving relationships, and he's given us a gift to keep you encouraged. And whether you're a teacher or you're a kids worker, or whether you are just someone who is a friend or a parent or a grandparent, to help change the lives of the people that you love, pray for them and add six words, I see God at work in you. And don't forget that there is only one, where we taste and see that the Lord is good, where we discover that the only real good one that we have discovered, where we can treasure and trust, is that it is God himself. Taste and see that the Lord is good. He will be at work doing good in the hearts of his people. Let's pray together. Father, we need you for this. We trust you for this. And this is the well. Your goodness is the well that we draw from. Work in the hearts and lives of our beautiful people that you're at work transforming, sanctifying. We pray today that you would help us to be the kind of people that you desire to have loving relationships, and let us do it because of your mercy, because of the good that you have done for us and in us. Pray for new change and transformation that you generate by your Spirit, we ask in Jesus' name.